Much of their modest edge would intro stats students retain months or years after the final exam. College majors also measurably hone specific kinds of reasoning. One ambitious study tested undergraduates at the University of Michigan during the first term of their first year, then retested the same students during the second term of their fourth year. The test covered verbal reasoning, statistical reasoning, and conditional reasoning. Researchers included four kinds of majors: natural sciences, humanities, social sciences, and psychology. Each major sharply improved on precisely one subtest. Social science and psychology majors became much better at statistical reasoning, the ability to apply the law of large numbers and the regression or base rate principles to both scientific and everyday life contexts. Natural science and humanities majors became much better at conditional reasoning, the ability to correctly analyze if-then and if-and-only-if problems. On remaining subtests, however, gains after 3.5 years of college were modest or non-existent. Social scientists' verbal and conditional reasoning scores slightly fell. Psychologists' verbal scores slightly rose, but their conditional reasoning failed to improve. Natural science and humanities majors gained slightly in verbal reasoning and modestly in statistical reasoning. With zero transfer, psychologists could only statistically analyze psychological issues, and natural scientists could only conditionally reason about their scientific specialty. Matters are not quite so dire. As the researchers conclude, their results show different undergraduate disciplines teach different kinds of reasoning to different degrees. Yet their results also undermine the view that students gain general reasoning skills. Students primarily improve in the very tasks they study and practice. Even this isn't guaranteed. Humanities majors' verbal reasoning barely budged. The same researchers also measured the effect of 2 years of graduate training on verbal, statistical, and conditional reasoning. The subjects were law students, medical students, and graduate students in psychology and chemistry at the University of Michigan. No one, not even law students, improved much in verbal reasoning. Chemists' scores on all three subtests stayed about the same, but medical and especially psychology students improved in statistical reasoning, and law, medical, and psychology students all improved in conditional reasoning. Takeaway: if all goes well, students learn what they study and practice. Psychology and medical students heavily use statistics, so they improve in statistics. Law and chemistry students rarely encounter statistics, so they don't improve in statistics. Why don't chemistry students improve in conditional reasoning? Because unlike psychology, medical, and law students, chemists have little need to differentiate among the various types of causal relations because chemistry deals primarily with necessary and sufficient causes. What chemistry students learn is chemistry. Actually, that's optimistic. Educational psychologists have also discovered that much of our knowledge is inert. Students who excel on exams frequently fail to apply their knowledge to the real world. Take physics. A student once joked, "Objects in motion remain in motion in the classroom, but come to rest on the playground." But the pedagogical problem is serious. Renowned psychologist Howard Gardner explains, "Researchers at Johns Hopkins, MIT, and other well-regarded universities have documented that students who receive honor grades in college-level physics courses are frequently unable to solve basic problems and questions encountered in a form slightly different from that on which they have been formally instructed and tested. If you throw a coin straight up, how many forces act on it in midair? The textbook answer is one. After it leaves your hand, the only force on the coin is gravity. The popular answer, however, is two. The force of the throw keeps sending it up, and the force of gravity keeps dragging it down. Popular with whom? Virtually everyone. Physics students included. At the beginning of the semester, only 12% of college students in introductory mechanics get the coin problem right. At the end of the semester, 72% still get it wrong. After students learn how to handle complex homework and exam problems, few apply their lessons to simple, real-world cases. The same goes for students in biology, mathematics, statistics, and, I'm embarrassed to say, economics. I strive to teach my students how to think like economists, to connect lectures to the real world and daily life. When teaching educational signaling in labor economics, I tell students, do you think you're going to get a job that uses your knowledge of educational signaling? Probably not. Yet if you don't learn the material, employers hold it against you. That's the puzzle. My exams are designed to measure comprehension, not memorization. They're completely open book, yet students' performance reliably disappoints me. Half the answers repeat semi-relevant passages from the notes and hope for mercy. In a good class, 4 exams out of 40 demonstrate true economic understanding. Howard Gardner captures my experience perfectly. Nearly every teacher I know would claim to teach for understanding. Certainly, I would make that claim myself. But if pressed to demonstrate that our students understand, we soon realize how slender is the reed of our confidence. Transfer researchers usually begin their careers as idealists. Before studying educational psychology, they take their power to teach students how to think for granted. When they discover the professional consensus against transfer, they think they can overturn it. Eventually, though, young researchers grow sadder and wiser. The scientific evidence wears them down, and their firsthand experience as educators finishes the job. Hear the pedagogical odyssey of psychologist Douglas Detterman. When I began teaching, I thought it was important to make things as hard as possible for students so they would discover the principles for themselves. I thought the discovery of principles was a fundamental skill that students needed to learn and transfer to new situations. Now I view education, even graduate education, as the learning of information. I try to make it as easy for students as possible. Where before I was ambiguous about what a good paper was, I now provide examples of the best papers from past classes. Before, I expected students to infer the general conclusion from specific examples. Now I provide the general conclusion and support it with specific examples. In general, I subscribe to the principle that you should teach people exactly what you want them to learn in a situation as close as possible to the one in which the learning will be applied. I don't count on transfer, and I don't try to promote it, except by explicitly pointing out where taught skills may be applied. Detterman is admittedly fatalistic even for an educational psychologist. Many of his peers struggle to learn from the rare examples of successful transfer. A few earnestly claim to have discovered novel teaching techniques that do reliably lead to transfer. For our purposes, however, this debate is a red herring. Though some educational psychologists deny that education must yield minimal transfer, almost all admit that actually existing education does yield minimal transfer. The upshot? Human capital purists can't credibly dismiss the disconnect between what we learn in school and what we do on the job. Relevance is highly relevant. If what you learn in school lacks obvious real-world applications, you'll probably never apply it. When a rare opportunity to use trigonometry knocks, it knocks too faintly to hear. The clash between teachers' grand claims about learning how to learn and a century of careful research is jarring. Yet common sense skepticism is a shortcut to the expert consensus. Teachers plea that we're mediocre at teaching what we measure but great at teaching what we don't measure is comically convenient. When someone insists their product has big, hard-to-see benefits, you should be dubious by default, especially when the easy-to-see benefits are small. In the classroom, educators strive to achieve tangible, self-contained goals, like teaching key Civil War facts. Should we believe educators are better at intangible, open-ended goals like teaching students how to think? When we hand teachers an explicit goal and measure their success, it's disappointing. Should we believe teachers are better at achieving unmeasured afterthoughts? Students quickly forget most of the material we deliberately try to teach them. Should we believe that students retain more of the skills we idly hope they'll acquire? You could object common sense cuts both ways. The strongest reason to believe in learning how to learn is also a common sense claim. Since physical exercise builds physical muscles, we should expect mental exercise to build mental muscles. But on reflection, this is another reason to disbelieve in learning how to learn. You don't exercise your legs to improve your bench press. You don't even exercise your right leg to strengthen your left leg. Instead, you exercise the muscles you seek to build. Why would mental muscles be any less specific? Furthermore, when you stop going to the gym, your physical muscles soon atrophy. Why would mental muscles be any slower to wither? If exercise analogies prove anything, they prove our education system rests on educators' conceit, the self-serving line that when we teach students whatever interests us, they durably acquire whatever skills they need to succeed in life. Making you smarter. While educators often promise to teach students how to think, they rarely vow to raise students' intelligence. Trying to make your pupils smarter smacks of hubris. However, when you look at data on IQ, psychologists' standard measure of intelligence, education matters. Summer vacation, intermittent attendance, delayed school entry, and dropping out all measurably depress IQ. Some experimental early childhood programs have increased IQ by over 30 points, moving kids' performance from roughly the second percentile to the 50th percentile of their age group. Extra years of education usually seem to boost IQ. Studies that carefully measure students' time show IQ rises more on school days than non-school days. Isn't this conclusive evidence that education makes us smarter? Not really. While the facts are secure, the interpretation is shaky. The first major worry, people can sharply improve on virtually any test by practicing, and a little practice goes a long way. A major review pulled together 50 relevant studies of practice on cognitive tests. On average, a candidate who scored at the 50th percentile on the first test could be expected to score at the 60th percentile on the second test and at the 71st percentile on the third test. Explicit coaching, teaching to the test, works even better. A cockeyed optimist might rejoice that mankind is only a few hours of practice away from massive intelligence gains. This optimism, however, leads to absurdity. Can you transform average students into geniuses by handing them the answer key before their IQ test? Most researchers draw the sobering conclusion that test preparation yields only hollow gains. Preparation inflates measured intelligence without raising genuine intelligence. The fact that test preparation yields large but hollow gains hardly shows that all large gains are hollow. Still, the power of preparation should make us suspicious. Maybe education raises IQ because education is a diluted form of IQ test preparation. As psychologist Stephen Sesse explains, it is through direct forms of instruction that children learn the answers to many of the questions that appear on a popular IQ and other aptitude tests. For example, within a given grade level, there is a correlation between the total number of hours of schooling a child receives and scores on verbal and mathematical aptitude tests. Similarly, there are negative correlations between the total number of teacher or student absences and scores on such tests. Also, quantitative and language-related scores are strongly correlated with the length of the school day and with the actual amount of time on task beginning in first grade. So it makes intuitive sense that much of the knowledge that aptitude tests, including IQ, tap, is accumulated through direct encounters with the educational system. Answers to questions on the WISCR, such as, in what continent is Egypt, who wrote Hamlet, what is the boiling point of water, and how many miles is New York from L.A., are probably learned through direct teaching methods. Teachers may not be aware that they are teaching answers to questions on IQ tests, but this is precisely what they are doing in their history, reading, literature, geography, and math classes. Sesse also notes that schools teach students to offer the kinds of answers IQ tests favor. How are an apple and an orange alike? IQ tests award only partial credit for such factually correct answers as they're both round, they're both edible, or they both have seeds. For full credit, you have to say they're both fruits. School also trains students to sit still and pay attention. These help test scores, but aren't intelligence in any normal sense of the word. If education truly raised intelligence, education would enhance performance on all sorts of cognitive challenges, in and out of the classroom. In reality, the gains are spotty. Probably the best study of the effect of education on IQ looks at the scores of over 100,000 18-year-old Swedish men. The researchers knew each student's exact age and test date, yielding a precise measure of their time in school. Major finding, school days noticeably raise scores on synonym and technical comprehension subtests without raising scores on spatial and logic subtests. The authors infer that education raises crystallized intelligence, but not fluid intelligence. A better interpretation, though, is that education improves some specific skills without increasing intelligence at all. Given how little students usually learn, Swedish schools' measured effect on the synonym and technical comprehension subtests is impressive. Still, to equate subject-specific gains with higher intelligence smacks of double counting. Worries about hollow IQ gains are admittedly a tad philosophical. The other major worry about the effect of education on IQ, however, is completely pragmatic. Suppose for the sake of argument that IQ perfectly captures genuine intelligence. When IQ goes up, genuine intelligence automatically rises in sync. Even in this scenario, a large effect of education on IQ would be impressive only if it were lasting. In the short story Flowers for Algernon, a mentally retarded man named Charlie Gordon receives an experimental treatment to cure his disability. Charlie's intelligence eventually rises to the level of genius, but the transformation is tragically short-lived. By the end of the story, all of Charlie's intellectual progress evaporates. In one sense, the experiment worked. In a deeper sense, it failed. Flowers for Algernon is science fiction, but life mirrors art. Making IQ higher is easy. Keeping IQ higher is hard. Researchers call this fade-out. Fade-out for early childhood education is especially well-documented. After 6 years in the famous Milwaukee Project, experimental subjects' IQs were 32 points higher than controls. By age 14, this advantage had declined to 10 points. In the Perry preschool program, experimental subjects gained 13 points of IQ, but all this vanished by age 8. Head Start raises preschoolers' IQs by a few points, but gains disappear by the end of kindergarten. You could object that preschoolers are unusually prone to forget what they learn, but the pattern extends all through high school. Extensive research on summer learning loss compares student scores at the end of one school year to the scores at the beginning of the next school year. The average student intellectually regresses roughly one full month during a 3-month summer vacation. The older the students, the steeper their decline. For reading, to take the clearest case, first and second graders actually slightly improve over the summer. By the time students are in middle school, however, one summer vacation wipes out over 3 months of reading proficiency. Reformers tend to see summer learning loss as an argument for year-round school. If summer makes students stupid, let's abolish summer. The flaw in their thinking? Everyone graduates eventually. Once you graduate, you're no longer in school, and learning loss kicks in. To quote Tiger Mother Amy Chua, every day you don't practice is a day that you're getting worse. Does education have any effect on genuine intelligence? Despite decades of research, we really don't know. What we do know is that education has far less effect than meets the eye. The effect of education on intelligence may not be entirely hollow, but it is largely hollow. The effect of education on intelligence may not be entirely temporary, but it is largely temporary. In any case, suppose each year of school permanently made you a whopping 3 IQ points smarter. According to standard estimates, this would raise your earnings by about 3%, leaving a supermajority of the education premium unexplained. How people get good at their jobs. If schools teach few job skills, transfer of learning is mostly wishful thinking, and the effect of education on intelligence is largely hollow. How on earth do human beings get good at their jobs? The same way you get to Carnegie Hall. Practice. People learn by doing specific tasks over and over. To get better at piloting, you fly planes. To get better at obstetrics, you deliver babies. To get better at carpentry, you build houses. For the unskilled, progress is easy. Given common sense conditions, it's almost guaranteed. In the words of K. Anders Ericsson, the world's leading expert on expertise, novices improve as long as they are, one, given a task with a well-defined goal, two, motivated to improve, three, provided with feedback, and four, provided with ample opportunities for repetition and gradual refinements of their performance. Before long, though, the benefit of mere practice plateaus. To really get good at their jobs, people must advance to deliberate practice. They must exit their comfort zone, raise the bar, struggle to surmount it, repeat. As Ericsson and co-authors explain, you need a particular kind of practice, deliberate practice, to develop expertise. When most people practice, they focus on the things they already know how to do. Deliberate practice is different. It entails considerable, specific, and sustained efforts to do something you can't do well, or even at all. Attaining world-class expertise in chess, music, math, tennis, swimming, long-distance running, writing, and science requires many years of deliberate practice. Fortunately, the labor market offers plenty of sub-pinnacle opportunities. A few thousand hours of deliberate practice rarely makes you a superstar, but it is ample time to get good in most occupations. People don't become skilled workers by dabbling in a dozen different school subjects. They become skilled workers by devoting years to their chosen vocation, by doing their job, and striving to do it better. Discipline and socialization. I doubt very seriously whether anyone will hire me. What do you mean, babe? You a fine boy with a good education. Employers sense in me a denial of their values. John Kennedy Toole, A Confederacy of Dunces. Educators boast that they teach their students how to think. Laymen tend to favor a colder, more credible story about what kids learn in school. Discipline and socialization. Life isn't a picnic or a game of solitaire. Schools build discipline by making students show up on time, sit still, keep their mouths shut, follow orders, and stay awake. Schools build social skills by making students cooperate, manage conflict, work as a team, dress nicely, and speak properly. The typical worker spends the day doing boring work in a hierarchical organization. Perhaps education acclimates children to their future role. These are all plausible claims, especially when you ponder the many thousands of hours of drudgery and mingling students endure. Yet discipline and socialization stories overlook a vital question. If students weren't in school, what would they be doing instead? Young adults who spent their teens sitting home alone playing video games might be feral. But what if young adults spent their teens working? Work teaches discipline. Work teaches social skills. Why would education be any better at readying us for the world of work than the world of work itself? What school inculcates is not so much the work ethic as the school ethic. The two ethics do not perfectly coincide. Both school and work teach you to follow orders and cooperate with others, yet they define and measure success differently. School elevates abstract understanding over practical results, passing exams over passing the market test, and fairness over dollars and cents. Andrew Carnegie caustically captures this tension. Men have sent their sons to colleges to waste their energies upon obtaining a knowledge of such languages as Greek and Latin, which are of no more practical use to them than Choctaw. They have been crammed with the details of petty and insignificant skirmishes between savages and taught to exalt a band of ruffians into heroes, and we have called them educated. They have been educated as if they were destined for life upon some other planet than this. What they have obtained has served to imbue them with false ideas and to give them a distaste for practical life. Had they gone into active work during the years spent at college, they would have been better educated men in every true sense of that term. The fire and energy have been stamped out of them, and how to so manage as to live a life of idleness and not a life of usefulness has become the chief question with them. Educators who dismiss Carnegie as a Neanderthal or Philistine prove my point. School inculcates many attitudes that, regardless of their moral worth, impede on-the-job success. If you're preparing kids for their adult roles, a year of work experience instills more suitable discipline and socialization than a year of school. The imperfect overlap between the school ethic and the work ethic is especially blatant in modern American colleges. 50 years ago, college was a full-time job. The typical student spent 40 hours a week in class or studying. Since the early 1960s, effort collapsed across the board. Full-time college students averaged 27 hours of academic work per week and only 14 hours of studying. As the leading researchers on this topic explain, no group appears to have bucked the trend. Study times fell for all choices of major, overall, and within both sub-periods. Students at liberal arts colleges studied more than other students, but study times fell at all types of colleges. Finally, data on SAT scores and school size show declines in study time for students of all ability levels, and at universities of all sizes and levels of selectivity. What are students doing with their extra free time? Having fun. Instead of being socialized for lives of boring work in hierarchical organizations, they're being socialized for lives of play and self-expression. As Richard Aram and Josipa Roxa frostily remark in their Academically Adrift, if we presume that students are sleeping 8 hours a night, which is a generous assumption given their tardiness and at times disheveled appearance in early morning classes, that leaves 85 hours a week for other activities. What is this additional time spent on? It seems to be spent mostly on socializing and recreation. A week in modern college is a great way to teach students that life is a picnic. A recent study of University of California undergraduates reported that while students spent 13 hours a week studying, they also spent 12 hours socializing with friends, 11 hours using computers for fun, 6 hours watching television, 6 hours exercising, 5 hours on hobbies, and 3 hours on other forms of entertainment. Grade inflation completes the idyllic package by shielding students from negative feedback. The average GPA is now 3.2. Instead of making students conform and submit, college showers students with acceptance. This doesn't merely fail to prepare students for their future roles, it actively unprepares them. College raises students' expectations to unrealistic heights, leaving future employers the chore of dragging graduates back down to earth. Yes, there's always the college molds character compared to sitting alone in your basement playing video games fallback. The relevant alternative, though, is a full-time job, and compared to that, college is a joke. As long as you avoid rare, demanding paths like engineering and pre-med in college, you bask in the warmth of a 4-year vacation. If that's socialization, it's dysfunctional socialization. In any case, imagine school and work really were equally effective ways to shape kids' souls to suit the workplace. How effective would that be? Labor economists have spent decades measuring the reward for work experience. A year of experience typically raises income by 2 to 3%. Some of this payoff has to reflect task-specific learning as opposed to discipline and socialization. Say it's half. Then a year's worth of character building is worth a 1 to 1.5% raise. Most estimates say a year of education is many times more lucrative. Even on generous assumptions, then, discipline and socialization explain a tiny sliver of the education premium. Who you know. About half of all workers used contacts, relatives, friends, acquaintances, to land their current job. You could argue that education pays despite low measured learning because we're inappropriately measuring what you know instead of who you know. Perhaps studying is overrated. Instead, the upwardly mobile student wins friends and influences people. The better your school, the better your connections after graduation. This story has a kernel of truth and is occasionally dead right. Overall, though, it's weak. The modern economy is vast and diverse. Few of the students you meet will end up in your line of work, even if they share your major. As a result, they'll probably never be in a position to help you. If you're looking for a good job, you don't want generic contacts. You want relevant contacts. Friends in your narrowly defined occupation are quite lucrative. So are older male relatives, father, uncle, grandfather, who know the boss or vouch for you. When researchers estimate the average benefit of contacts or social networks, though, some find a positive effect on employment and wages, some no effect, and others a negative effect. If this seems implausible, bear in mind, even if your cousin or college roommate plainly got you your job, you might have swiftly found as good or better a job on your own. Who does meet useful contacts at school? If you want a job in education, school is the ideal place to network. Once I resolved to become an economics professor, I strove to meet other economics professors. One, Tyler Cowen, got me my job. I also met many philosophy, history, and law professors. Career payoff so far? Zero. If you're earning a professional degree in law or medicine or majoring in more vocational subjects like engineering, you and your classmates will plausibly trade career favors down the line. Stanford's computer science program could be your passport to Silicon Valley. At some elite schools, fraternities funnel brothers into finance and consulting. Hell Week could land you on Wall Street. Normally, however, lucrative networking begins after students graduate and find a niche in the sprawling modern economy. The false promises of education. We asked the young people whether they remember having learned something important at school. It seemed to be a difficult question for most. Often the question was followed by long silences and embarrassed laughs. Elena Lahelma, School is for Meeting Friends. Education seems to pay. Human capital purism advances a single explanation. Education pays because education teaches lots of useful job skills. A tempting story until you stare at what schools teach, what students learn, and what adults know. Then human capital purism looks not just overstated, but Orwellian. Most of what schools teach has no value in the labor market. Students fail to learn most of what they're taught. Adults forget most of what they learn. When you mention these awkward facts, educators speak to you of miracles. Studying anything makes you better at everything. Never mind educational psychologists' century of research exposing these so-called miracles as soothing myths. An optimist could admittedly reframe my summary of the facts. If most of what schools teach has no value in the labor market, then some of what schools teach has value. If students fail to learn most of what they're taught, then students learn some of what they're taught. If adults forget most of what they learn, then adults remember some of what they learn. Fair enough. Yet the question remains, can the modest job skills we learn in school explain the extra pay we earn after graduation? The answer hinges on the size of the premium. At least on the surface, modern education seems highly lucrative. Does modest learning genuinely lead to immodest earning? Or are the apparently ample rewards of education a statistical illusion? Chapter 3. The Puzzle is Real. The Handsome Rewards of Useless Education. The world is full of unemployable experts. If you master all there is to know about the Civil War or Star Trek, employers will still scoff that you can't do anything with your esoteric knowledge. A tempting inference is that all the useless coursework students endure pays as poorly as any other geeky hobby. Daily life feeds temptation. Every unemployed college grad and cashier with a PhD seem like further proof that conventional academic curricula fail the market test. When you peruse income statistics, however, you behold a starkly different picture. As individuals' schooling rises, so does their pay. The earnings gap is enormous. In 2011, holders of advanced degrees made almost three times as much as high school dropouts. Each step up the educational ladder seems to count. A high school diploma may sound unworthy of mention in our information age, but high school graduates out-earn dropouts by 30%. The numbers come straight from the Census Bureau. These stats are solid, but what do they mean? Mainstream defenders of education tend to take the numbers at face value. Since college grads earn 73% more than high school grads, expect a 73% raise when you finish college. Contrarian detractors of education tend to take the numbers at no value. For all we know, college grads would have made 73% extra even if they never set foot on a college campus. Each side snubs the other. Defenders of education say education must provide lots of job skills because it pays so handsomely. Detractors of education say education can't pay handsomely because it provides so few job skills. Last chapter sided with detractors. Education, as we know it, fails to transform students into skilled workers. This chapter, however, sides with defenders. Education, as we know it, successfully transforms students into rich workers. After tempering defenders' optimism about learning, it's time to temper detractors' pessimism about earning. Affirming the financial rewards of education often confuses critics of the signaling model. Isn't it contradictory to claim the market rewards irrelevant education? No, 1,000 times no. The signaling model's whole purpose is to explain why education raises income more than job skills. Unless education has a larger effect on income than on job skills, there's nothing for the model to explain. The case for the signaling model is strongest if students learn zero in school and employers treat graduates like kings. My task would be simple and the chapter short if optimism about earning were bulletproof. Alas, matters are more complex. The raw numbers almost certainly exaggerate education's financial reward. Most of the statistical complaints you've heard, and several you haven't, hold water. Yet once we fix every major flaw with the raw numbers, a hefty effect of education on earnings persists. Credit where credit is due. The specter of ability bias. Human capital and signaling models both take the effect of education on income for granted. Should they be more skeptical? Keyed out, the labor market pays for the combined effect of two traits that go hand in hand, schooling and pre-existing ability. As Nobelist James Heckman puts it, ability and education are distinct, and both have economic rewards. To properly measure the effect of education on earnings, to avoid what economists call ability bias, you must compare workers with equal ability but unequal education. Consider Bill Gates, Harvard's most famous dropout. He plainly had the raw talent to finish his studies. Gates was already a prize-winning programmer by his sophomore year. It's unsurprising, then, that he out-earned run-of-the-mill college dropouts. To announce Gates would have earned 73% more if he'd finished college is obtuse. The same holds for everyone besides Bill Gates. The typical high school dropout was a below-average high school student. Dropouts who wonder how much they would have earned if they'd stayed in school should not, therefore, compare themselves to average high school graduates. They should compare themselves to below-average high school graduates. The typical college grad, similarly, was an above-average high school student. BAs who wonder what they owe to their college diploma should not compare themselves to average high school graduates. They should compare themselves to above-average high school graduates. The effect of education on income is like the effect of athletic practice on athletic prowess. People who practice more play better. Professional athletes practice the most and play the best. This doesn't mean I can be a professional football player if I practice enough. Why? Because professionals have two separate advantages over me, practice and pre-existing athletic ability, strength, size, agility, aggressiveness, youth, pain tolerance, and so on. To properly measure the benefit of football practice to avoid ability bias, you shouldn't compare me to pros who practice a lot. You should compare me to 165-pound, 46-year-old nerds with bad knees who practice a lot. So far, this audiobook has raced the human capital model against the signaling model. Ability bias challenges both models. Human capital, signaling, and ability bias are three separate competing stories about education, skill, and income. These stories are easiest to grasp in their pure forms, and each takes a stand on three distinct issues. Issue 1, visibility of skill. In the pure human capital and pure ability bias stories, skill is obvious. Employers effortlessly, instantly, and infallibly know what workers can and cannot do. In the pure signaling story, in contrast, skill is invisible. Employers must infer your skill from your resume. Issue number 2, education's effect on skill. In the pure human capital story, schooling enhances skill. Indeed, schooling is the sole reason why more educated workers are more skilled than less educated workers. What you see is what you get. In the pure signaling and pure ability bias models, in contrast, schooling has zero effect on skill. If students learn anything useful, they forget it all before joining the workforce. Issue number 3, education's effect on income. The pure human capital story says schooling raises your income by enhancing your skill. The pure signaling story says schooling raises your income by certifying your skill. Their bottom lines match. Schooling raises your income. Indeed, schooling is the sole reason why more educated workers out-earn less educated workers. What you see is what you get. In the pure ability bias story, though, schooling has zero effect on income. Since skill is obvious to employers and schooling fails to enhance skill, schooling does not pay. Given a clear explanation, most people readily grasp the conflict between human capital and its rivals. Yet even experts occasionally confuse signaling with ability bias. Both stories agree that employers value workers' skill. Both deny that schooling enhances workers' skill. The two stories diverge on the question of visibility. In a pure signaling story, employers never see your skill. So if your skills mismatch your credentials, the labor market rewards your credentials, not your skills. In a pure ability bias story, in contrast, employers see your skill plain as day. So if your skills mismatch your credentials, the labor market rewards your skills, not your credentials. Although human capital, signaling, and ability bias are best grasped in their pure forms, the truth is almost surely a mixture of the three. Suppose the mixture is one-third human capital, one-third signaling, one-third ability bias. In this scenario, employers gradually and fallibly detect the right stuff, so the labor market rewards both skills and credentials. If you're good, you can rise without diplomas. Still, unless you're a Bill Gates superstar, you'll rise faster and higher with the right diplomas to aid your ascent. Correcting for ability bias. What you see is more than what you get. How big is ability bias? The most compelling answers, A, measure ability, then B, compare the incomes of people with different educations but identical ability. Statistically speaking, you want to estimate the effect of education on earnings, correcting for ability. A solid answer required solid measures of all abilities that matter. In practice, education economists who worry about ability bias focus heavily on cognitive ability, especially general intelligence as measured by IQ. Imperfect though they are, IQ tests are a good faith effort to measure how smart people are and predict success inside and outside the classroom. Many researchers have recalculated the education premium after correcting for IQ and other measures of cognitive ability. Almost all the research has two conclusions in common. First, IQ pays. Holding education constant, an extra point of IQ raises earnings by about 1%. Second, holding IQ constant, the education premium shrinks but never vanishes. In 1999, a comprehensive review of earlier studies found that correcting for IQ reduces the education premium by an average of 18%. When researchers correct for scores on the Armed Forces Qualification Test, AFQT, an especially high-quality IQ test, the education premium typically declines by 20 to 30%. Correcting for mathematical ability may tilt the scales even more. The most prominent researchers to do so report a 40 to 50% decline in the education premium for men and a 30 to 40% decline for women. Internationally, correcting for cognitive skill cuts the payoff for years of education by 20%, leaving clear rewards of mere years of schooling in all 23 countries studied. The highest serious estimate finds the education premium falls 50% after correcting for students' 12th grade math, reading, and vocabulary scores, self-perception, perceived teacher ranking, family background, and location. A thinner body of research weighs the importance of so-called non-cognitive abilities, such as conscientiousness and conformity. The results parallel those for IQ. Non-cognitive ability pays, and correcting for non-cognitive ability reduces the education premium. Correcting for AFQT, self-esteem, and fatalism, belief about the importance of luck versus effort, reduces the education premium by a total of 30%. The sole study correcting for detailed personality tests finds the education premium falls 13%. The highest serious estimate says that once you correct for intelligence and background, correcting for attitudes such as fear of failure, personal efficacy and trust, and personal behavior such as church attendance, television viewing, and cleanliness, further cuts the education premium by 37%. There are admittedly two big reasons to mistrust these basic results: reverse causation and missing abilities. The former could systematically overstate the severity of ability bias. The latter could systematically understate the severity of ability bias. Need we fret over either flaw? Reverse causation. When you estimate the education premium correcting for ability X, you implicitly assume education does not enhance X. If this assumption is false, correcting for X leads to misleadingly low estimates of the effect of education on earnings. The best remedy for this reverse causation problem is to measure ability, then estimate the effect of subsequent education on earnings. Research on cognitive ability bias routinely applies this remedy and uncovers little evidence of reverse causation. The comprehensive review article mentioned earlier separated studies into two categories: those that measured IQ before school completion and those that measured IQ after school completion. If reverse causation were at work, studies that relied on IQ after completion would report more ability bias than studies that relied on IQ before completion. In fact, both categories yield similar estimates of cognitive ability bias. Researchers who rely on the AFQT and related tests reach a similar result. When you correct for cognitive ability in 1980, the payoff for post-test education falls at least as much as the payoff for pre-test education. Correcting for mathematical ability in the senior year of high school shaves 25 to 32% off the male college premium and 4 to 20% off the female college premium. What about reverse causation from education to non-cognitive ability? Truth be told, relevant research is sparse. A few papers grapple with the issue with mixed results. Most research, however, either measures non-cognitive ability and education at the same point in time, or fails to distinguish between the effect of pre- and post-test education. The shortage of evidence hardly shows reverse causation is a serious problem, but caution is in order. Missing abilities. Correcting for ability doesn't fully eliminate ability bias unless you measure all relevant abilities. Are there any important abilities we've overlooked? Family background, via nature or nurture, is a plausible contender. Perhaps wealthy families use their money to help their kids get good educations and good jobs. Maybe college is a 4-year vacation for rich kids and a status symbol for their parents. Perhaps children from large families get less educational and professional assistance from their parents. Maybe well-educated workers come from high-achieving families and would have been high achievers even without their schooling. The mechanism is hard to nail down, but most researchers find correcting for family background reduces the education premium by 0 to 15%. On reflection, though, correcting for family background probably double counts. Both cognitive and non-cognitive ability are moderately to highly hereditary, so you should correct for individual ability before you conclude family background overstates school's payoff. This caveat matters. Rare studies that correct for intelligence and family background find that correcting for intelligence alone suffices. Armed with good measures of cognitive and non-cognitive ability, we can probably safely ignore family background. The most troubling evidentiary gap? Researchers usually settle for mediocre measures of non-cognitive ability. Most studies that correct for non-cognitive ability rely on one or two hastily measured traits and find only mild ability bias. Yet when asked, employers hail the importance of workers' attitude and motivation, and the study with the best measures of non-cognitive ability finds large ability bias. Until better measures come along, we should picture existing results as a lower bound on non-cognitive ability bias rather than a solid estimate. So how severe is ability bias, all things considered? For cognitive ability bias, 20% is a cautious estimate, and 30% is reasonable. For non-cognitive ability bias, 5% is cautious, and 15% is reasonable. Correcting for ability gives the education premium quite a haircut, but not a shaved head. Education has a large payoff in every scenario, but the payoff you think you see is bigger than the payoff you really get. On the reasonable assumption of 30% cognitive plus 15% non-cognitive ability bias, dropping out of high school cuts income by almost 15%, a college degree boosts income by 40%, and a master's degree boosts income by almost 70%. When fans of education trumpet the raw education premium, skeptics are right to protest. College graduates and high school graduates differ in many ways besides the time they sat in classrooms. Yet, after correcting for all the differences we see or suspect, education still pays. Labor economists versus ability bias. Labor economists aren't merely attuned to the possibility of ability bias. They've long felt a professional responsibility to measure it. But over the last quarter century, labor economists have surprisingly moved to the view that there's not much bias to measure. A famous review of the evidence by eminent economist David Card concludes ability bias is small, non-existent, or even negative. I call this verdict the Card consensus. Many, perhaps most, elite labor economists not only embrace it, but rely on it for practical guidance. We see the Card consensus in top scholarly venues like the Journal of Economic Literature. The return to an additional year of education obtained for reasons like compulsory schooling or school-building projects is more likely to be greater than lower than the conventionally estimated return to schooling. We see the Card consensus in top policy initiatives like the Brookings Institution's Hamilton Project. It's possible and even likely that individual college graduates have different aptitudes and ambitions and might even have access to different levels of family resources. All these factors can impact earnings. However, the evidence suggests that these factors don't drive the impressive return to college. Instead, the increased earning power of college graduates appears to be caused by their educational investments. Even analysts who don't cite the Card consensus enjoy its protection. Well-publicized calculations of the value of college typically ignore ability bias altogether. The Card consensus neuters criticism of this omission. How can you attack a tacit 0% ability bias assumption as a fatal flaw when plenty of experts stand ready to defend it as a harmless simplification? This is a disorienting intellectual situation. Statistically naive laymen infer causation from correlation. Since college grads earn 73% more than high school grads, college causes a 73% raise. Economists who don't specialize in labor smirk at the layman's naivete. They take sizable ability bias for granted. But economists who do specialize in labor now largely stand with laymen. While ability bias is intuitively plausible, the Card consensus tells us, move along, nothing to see here. What about abundant research from last section that detects hefty ability bias? The Card consensus barely acknowledges it. Why not? Labor economists' most common rationale is that no one can measure all the abilities that cause both academic and career success. True enough, but that just means ability bias is worse than it looks. Supporters of the CARD consensus also occasionally muse that high-ability students might leave school sooner. Some people cut their schooling short so as to pursue more immediately lucrative activities. Sir Mick Jagger abandoned his pursuit of a degree at the London School of Economics in 1963 to play with an outfit known as the Rolling Stones. No less impressive, Swedish épée fencer Johan Harmenberg left MIT after 2 years of study in 1979, winning a gold medal in the 1980 Moscow Olympics instead of earning an MIT diploma. Harmenberg went on to become a biotech executive and successful researcher. These examples illustrate how people with high ability, musical, athletic, entrepreneurial, or otherwise, may be economically successful without the benefit of an education. This suggests that ability bias can be negative as easily as positive. Straightforward rebuttal. Name any ability the well-educated tend to lack. Outliers have ye always. But the well-educated are, on average, abler across the board. No one hears about someone quitting high school or college and says, wow, what a talented kid. At best, then, the CARD consensus casually throws away a large body of contrary evidence to get off the ground. But it's worse than that. The CARD consensus casually throws away the best evidence. Worried you're improperly giving school credit for pre-existing ability? There's a clear statistical cure. Measure pre-existing ability to allow an apples-to-apples comparison of people with equal ability but unequal schooling. The cures the CARD consensus prizes, in contrast, are anything but clear. Instead of sending researchers in search of better ability measures, it sends them in search of quasi-experiments, naturally occurring situations that mimic experiments. As a result, labor economists have collected a zoo of alleged educational quasi-experiments. Some study twins. As long as identical twins have equal ability but unequal educations, education's true payoff equals their earnings gap divided by their education gap. Other scholars study the effect of season of birth on the theory that kids who are young for their grade are less legally eligible to drop out of high school. Since 2000, researchers have been most transfixed by changes in compulsory attendance laws. If government forces students who would have dropped out to stay in school, what happens to their income after graduation? While technically impressive, all these papers raise more questions than they answer. To treat changes in compulsory attendance laws as a quasi-experiment, for example, we must assume states change these laws at random, or at least for reasons unrelated to the job market. Once a quasi-experimental approach picks up steam, moreover, critics usually uncover deep flaws. Identical twins with different educations don't have identical ability. The more educated twin is usually the smarter twin. Season of birth is not random. It correlates with health, region, and possibly income. On closer look, the supposed fruits of U.S. compulsory attendance laws mask unrelated regional trends, especially in the South. None of this means quasi-experimental studies of the education premium are worthless, or their critics invariably on target. But compared to directly measuring pre-existing ability, such studies are speculative and unconvincing. Since the cleanest approach reveals hefty ability bias and the messy alternatives yield mixed results, we should reject the CARD consensus in favor of the common sense view that ability bias is all too real. Wheat versus chaff? How can education be so irrelevant yet so lucrative? There exists one clean explanation, call it the wheat-chaff theory, that doesn't appeal to signaling. In this story, education is a mixture of high-paid wheat, literacy, numeracy, critical thinking, technical training, and unpaid chaff, history, Latin, gym, French poetry. Schooling is lucrative because official statistics take real classes and real majors and lump them together with Mickey Mouse classes and Mickey Mouse majors. The wheat-chaff theory is no ringing endorsement of the status quo. The curriculum is a mixed bag of invaluable preparation and irrelevant filler, leaves ample room for improvement. You might even say wheat-chaff damns the education system with faint praise. Still, if this story is correct, the education system, for all its faults, genuinely transforms student-led into worker-gold. Looking at the evidence, however, the wheat-chaff theory is exaggerated at best. Wheat arguably pays more than chaff, but chaff definitely pays too. Since most academic programs require ample chaff for admission and or graduation, the financial rewards of accrued chaff should not surprise you. Wheat, chaff, and coursework. Several research teams use people's high school transcripts to predict their adult earnings. One of the earliest and most influential papers found that ignoring pre-existing ability, extra classes in math, foreign language, and industrial arts modestly increase earnings, but extra classes in English, social studies, and fine arts modestly reduce earnings. Correcting for ability, however, the bonus for extra math steals.